Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 301, and we're going to talk about 10 overrated van life things. These are things that new van lifers think they must have or that they're better, but they aren't. We're also going to talk about fixing that wet carpet on the passenger side of your van. You probably know what I'm talking about. A tale from the road involving, volcanoes. And a little bit about how to grow a garden in your van. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me here once again. I am back in the United States of America. Now that we're 250 years old. Anyway, back to business. So I thought I would talk about 10 overrated van life things. Now, disclaimer, very important disclaimer. These are my opinions. And in this list of 10 things, if one of these doesn't annoy you, then I've not done my job. But I would like you to just simply go to bed tonight with the knowledge that, Jeff said these things, but he's just wrong. Yes, that is fine. That is the whole point of this. But I've been around a while. I've been paying attention. And, well, these are things, based on my opinion, that are overrated in van life. And, one of them is pretty controversial, and several of them might be. All of these can easily start a fight on the internet. But, let's see which one of these you disagree with. So, starting with number one overrated thing in van life. Televisions. You do not need a TV in your van. Now, the truth is that most of the quote-unquote van life community already knows this, and they don't have TVs. It's the RV community that feels like every vehicle has to have a TV in it. My truck camper has a big wall and a little tiny truck camper all set up to mount a TV. There's a powered antenna, although there's no antenna on the roof, which tells me that this vehicle has had an interesting history. And in my Airstream, it came with not one, but two TVs with a powered antenna and a cable TV outlet on the outside that I will never use. And the powered antenna doesn't seem to work anyway. And I don't care because I don't need TVs. Now, to be fair, my wife and I, do use the TV in the quote-unquote living room section of the Airstream, but that's because the Airstream's big. It's a 27-foot-long vehicle. The room is actually big. If that TV wasn't there, I don't think we'd care very much. But seriously, if you're building out a van, you don't need a TV. And the reason is not that you shouldn't be watching TV. You're supposed to be out in nature. Look, I'm not here preaching about how you do your van life. If you like watching TV in your van or your tent or wherever you happen to be, I don't care. That's your business. How you spend your time is completely up to you. What I'm saying is you don't need a dedicated television in your van. An iPad, a Samsung tablet, your computer, all of these things do more than a TV does. And in almost every case, that's all you need. And often if you need to have movie night and you're going to have a bunch of people watching, a projector is a better option than a television. It's nighttime. You can shine it on the side of your van. You can put up a sheet. You can get a screen if you're that fancy. Whatever. There's a lot of very small projectors that you can travel with. I have an Anker Mars Nebula that I travel with. It's fairly small. It's half a loaf of bread or so. Because again, American can't use any real measurements that wouldn't count. And it's fine. It works great. It has enough sound that, that would really be all I needed. But it's a little old and I don't actually recommend that anymore. I think if you do go towards a projector, get one that is USB powered or chargeable at the very least. Number two, getting a little bit more controversial here, awnings. Awnings are overrated, and this has a big asterisk next to it. The reason I say that is because a lot of van life folks travel a lot. If you are doing the kind of travel where you're not traveling a lot, that is that you're parking somewhere for a week or 2 weeks or whatever, your opinion of awnings is probably different. You probably love your awning. But the reason I put this down as overrated is a lot of people never, ever use their awnings. They buy a fancy rig with an awning and then never use it. And then another group of people don't use it because it's complicated. And this is the problem with awnings. They're complicated. You have to watch them. The wind can destroy them and possibly your rig. They can be a little bit dangerous, actually, depending on the kind of awning you have. If something happens with that spring and you're messing with it, it can be a problem. And because of that, I have added this to the list as overrated. What's often better than an awning is a pop-up canopy, something that you can put next to your van or move away from your van. For example, you may have a place where you're staying, but there's this lovely picnic table that's kind of far from the van. If you had a pop-up canopy, you could put that over the picnic table. Or if you're in a place where the sun's bothering you in the morning and in the late evening, you can move a canopy to whichever side of the van is affected. And obviously, you can't move an awning. You could move your van. Yes, I know. So just a thought. You know, if you have an awning, I'm not suggesting that you rip it off or anything like that, but if you're just starting out in van life, don't worry about the awning at this point. You can always add one if it makes sense, but you don't have to, and there are portable options that work just as well. Number three, built-in cooktops. Let's be very careful here about what I'm talking about. I'm talking about cooktops that are built into your van, like in your kitchen at home. They don't move. They're built in there. I think they're not so great. I mean, I have them, of course. My Sprinter van, I put one in. My Airstream has one. The Tiki Bago has one. And the truck camper has one. But my pod that I'm building out will not have one. And the reason is twofold. Number one, they take up space. Your cooktop is just going to eat up that space forever. And yes, you can put covers on them, and then you can put stuff on the cover. But I find that you often, like, will have a tea kettle on there. And then if you have to put down the cover, you're going to find some place to put the tea kettle. And I guess it just becomes a pain in the butt. And what I find is a better option is to have the cooktop just be a portable butane cooktop or a portable induction cooktop, something that you can put away when you're not using it or take outside if you want to cook outside. That's much, much more flexible. And for the cost of the built-in cooktops and the necessary plumbing, and that means you have to have a propane tank in almost all cases, unless you're doing a built-in induction, which is fine. But again, why? You can get a portable that does the same thing. Now, the one exception I'll put here is if you have one of those combination sink cooktops in a small van. Okay, that's fine. Those have uses. I'm not so offended by those. I'm not offended. But I think a portable butane cooker for $30 is so inexpensive, so easy to use, and so portable that, honestly, I would always look there. And I always travel with one, even if I do have a built-in cooktop. Number four. Water heaters. Now, why not have a water heater? Well, I like hot water. I like to take showers in hot water. Yeah, I get that. I understand. Water heaters are overrated because they are high entropy devices. They're things that break often. They need winterization. And if you have the traditional 6-gallon hot water heater, they really complicate winterization. They also tend to leak. They tend to get scale. They have an anode in them often that will need to be changed every so often. They can harbor bacteria, and they take up a ton of space. Now, if you have the instant hot water heaters, which are getting more common, they're a little bit better. And honestly, the portable ones that you kind of hang on the back door, I don't really have a problem with those. If you are taking a lot of showers in your van, it might be worth it to have some kind of a hot water solution. But other than that, like for washing your hands and stuff, you don't need hot water. And if you do have a need for hot water, just boil some on the stove. That's really all you need. Now, if you're going to build out some big fancy rig and you desperately want to have hot water, that's fine. Just make sure you know what you're getting into. But in my experience, I don't miss hot water. I mean, I have a hot water heater in the Airstream, and there's a hot water heater in the truck camper, and I just don't use them that much. I just don't care. I will turn the one in the Airstream on if I'm going to take a shower, which isn't all that often. And the truck camper doesn't even have a shower. It just has a sink. And the 6-gallon hot water heater is just to make hot water come out of the sink. For those of you saying that you can't clean dishes without hot water, you can. You absolutely can. You need to use different soap, maybe. Some soaps need the hot water to dissolve, but I can tell you that Dawn dishwashing liquid is fine in cold water. The trick is to dry the dishes with a cloth. If you do that, that takes off any kind of film or anything that you might have left behind that maybe the hot water would have helped with. Now, one trick I use, because I don't have a hot water heater, is I have a battery-powered shower head. It's just a little, it's a hose with a little pump and a shower head on it. I can heat water, put it in a bucket, and then that's my hot water for washing my hair or whatever I want to do. That works well, and I don't need a separate hot water heater for it. Number 5, water filters. This has a big caveat. I don't think you should be drinking the water that's in your water tank in your vehicle, simply because making that water potable and tasty is a lot of work. It's a pain in the butt. But making it safe enough to use for showers and cleaning things like dishes is pretty easy. It's not that much work. And so that's what I recommend you do. If you have a built-in water tank for your vehicle, use that water just for cleaning, which is the massive bulk. For drinking water and cooking water, depending, just have a separate tank for that. Have a jug, even a few gallons of water, just in regular old, you know, gallon jugs that you get at the store. Stick them in a closet, stick them on the floor, wherever they fit. Pull one out and use it. And that, honestly, that's what we use in the Airstream. The Airstream's got this big, huge water tank. I think it's 60 gallons. I forget. It's either 40 or 60. It's a big tank. We don't use it for cooking or drinking. We have a separate water source for that, and it's just because it's simpler. I've seen people install these fancy water filters in their vans, like 3-stage water filters or UV water filters, and all these things add complexity and take up space and make winterizing a problem. And my Tiki Bago has an instant-on kind of water filter at the sink, and there's this cartridge there, and if I don't remember to remove that, it will explode every winter. And yeah, guess how I know that. So anyway, I don't think water filters are that necessary. If you're in a serious wilderness situation where you're sourcing your water from streams and stuff, that's a different story. Then you do want some kind of a water filter system. But I would recommend something along the lines of Life Straw or one of those where it's a bag that the water just filters through it. I don't see any reason to install any kind of permanent water filter. Number 6, let's jump right into controversy here. Standing room is overrated. I know, you're like, you're crazy. There's no way I could have a van that I can't stand in. Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, except that you can, and I've done it, and people do it all the time, and honestly, it's not that big of a deal. The secret is to make everything doable while you're sitting. So my NV200, obviously I couldn't stand in that. I think the inside ended up being 52 inches in height, and I'm 72 inches, so there was a whole 20 inches missing there. I couldn't stand in that. And it didn't matter. Literally, the only thing I had trouble with was putting on my pants. That was the one thing I really wished I could stand for. And yeah, I could do it outside, but sometimes that's not convenient. So I had to invent this way of like scoochying while I was in the bed and stuff. That was the only annoying thing that really mattered. Other than that, I was sitting in the seat. I cooked sitting. I washed dishes sitting. I did everything sitting, and that totally worked. When I got the Sprinter van, which I could stand in, that was very luxurious. I loved being able to stand in there, and yes, it added a lot more storage space, which is a valid thing, a valid counter-argument to my argument that standing space is overrated. But standing space also costs. You know, the vehicle's more expensive. Some things in the vehicle are harder to do because you have longer runs and things like that. In some cases, you can't reach the ceiling, depending on your height and how big the van is, which is a problem. And it also is likely to reduce your gas mileage because the vehicle's simply taller. Also means that in some cases, you can't go through drive-thrus and things like that. So on the whole, when I balance everything, I think standing room is very nice, but it is also overrated. Both things can be true. Number 7, absolutely the most controversial thing I will say, and I've been challenged on this many, many times, and I'm sorry, the data backs up my position, and I'm happy to have a conversation with you. It's insulation. insulation. You will find so many people telling you that the most important thing about your van build is insulation. And they're probably saying that because it's hard to add after your build is done. But depending on the type of travel you do, insulation can be a detriment, and that is what I found with my NV200. So, NV200, made by Nissan, little van, shorter than a minivan, a little bit taller, about 75 inches by 44 inches living space inside, something like that. Not a lot, but I insulated the heck out of that thing. Boy, I insulated every little crack and crevice. I had polyiso and rock wool, and some places I had to use Reflectix because it was the only thing that fit. I mean, if I could insulate something, it was insulated in that van. And what I found was that in the winter, it didn't really matter much because it was cold and the heater was going to easily overwhelm whatever cold there was. I mean, I could have heated that thing even if there was no insulation with a diesel heater, although I wasn't actually using that at the time. In the summer, what happened is it would take a while. You know, I had this nice buffer because the insulation would keep it cooler inside longer. But eventually, the heat would overwhelm the insulation, and then the interior would assume the same temperature as the outside. All insulation does is slow that process down. Eventually, there's going to be an equilibrium between the inside of the van and the outside of the van. A lot of people don't believe me. They think somehow the insulation generates heat or something. That isn't how it works. All it does is slow the transfer of temperature from the inside to the outside. But it's eventually going to happen. And it's usually going to happen in hours, if not less than that, meaning that if you're in a place where it's very hot at noon or, say, 6 p.m., but is actually comfortable at 9 p.m., the insulation is a detriment. It keeps the heat in the vehicle longer. So if you're trying to cool it off at night, everything in the van is warm and it's harder for that heat to get out. That is why I say insulation is overrated. The only time I will disagree with that is if you are in a situation where you're keeping your van the same temperature all the time. If you're running AC all the time, or you're running heat all the time, then insulation can help you save some money on the energy costs of doing that. But if you're like most people, and you have heat, but not an air conditioner, insulation is only useful in that it can prevent condensation on the inside of the van. Now, it can also, you know, Reflectix on the windows is useful. It can stop the sun from getting in. A little bit of insulation is good. But going crazy with insulation, I don't think it's a good idea, and I think it can actually make your van life less enjoyable. Disagree? I'm fine with that. Feel free to contact me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. But you're going to have to bring evidence if you're going to try to change my mind on that. Number 8, four-wheel drive. You might be surprised to hear me say that, but I do believe four-wheel drive is overrated. And by that, I mean it's the desire for four-wheel drive that's overrated. You don't need it. You don't. Unless you're going to spend all your time rock crawling. You're not going to rock crawl in a van. Just put those dreams aside. Unless you're going to be spending significant amounts of time off-road in places where traction's going to be difficult and you have a lot of extra money, I don't recommend four-wheel drive. My NV200, front-wheel drive vehicle with a CVT. It didn't even have a real transmission. I went all over the country, everywhere, including way out into the desert. I mean, I took this thing to Aurora, Nevada, which is a ghost town, 20 miles off-road. It's not rock crawling. It's, you know, it's passable. But this vehicle is definitely not made for off-road. And I had crappy tires on this thing. And I never, ever got stuck once. Not once. And the reason is, I know what to avoid when I'm driving. I have off-road experience. I actually went to Land Rover driving school, if you can believe that. And because I have that, I need four-wheel drive a lot less than somebody who maybe wasn't experienced. But I'll tell you what, four-wheel drive isn't magic. You can easily get stuck with four-wheel drive, and if you do, then you're in real trouble because you can dig in four wheels instead of just two, and it's much harder to get out. You know what's more important than four-wheel drive, other than, you know, learning how to drive in a way that you don't get stuck, which is, of course, important? Tires. tires. A two-wheel drive vehicle with good quality tires and a competent driver is going to be better performing than a four-wheel drive vehicle with crappy tires and a less competent driver. It's true. So when you figure that four-wheel drive costs a lot more money to add, it adds a lot of mechanical complexity, it lowers your fuel mileage, and it costs a lot more to maintain and repair, I think four-wheel drive is overrated, especially the kind of four-wheel drive that you find in vans today. For example, Sprinters and Transits, they don't really have four-wheel drive. What they have, what they call four-wheel drive is more accurately described as all-wheel drive, and getting into the differences is a very long topic, but if you're curious, absolutely search that out, because, you know, my Land Rover that I used to have was full-time four-wheel drive. That's at one end of the spectrum. And then, like, a Honda CR-V is at another end of the spectrum, and how they work is completely different, even though they use some of the same terminology. Number nine, a little less controversial now than it used to be, diesel engines. Now, I'm coming from a U.S. perspective. In other countries, this answer might be a little bit different because you guys have things like, you know, manual shift, which we do not have in the U.S. anymore for any vans that I'm aware of. Yeah, don't. Diesels are one of the most extremely overrated things in the world. Diesel engines function completely differently than gasoline engines in how the torque response is done. Basically, a diesel can pull a lot more weight for a lot less energy than a gasoline engine. Diesel engines also last longer because they don't get as hot, and, you know, diesel doesn't explode, it just kind of expands it, so there's a lot less stress on a diesel engine than there is on a gasoline engine. I mean, I like diesel engines. I own two of them in my tractors, which is a perfect application for a diesel engine. In a van, it's completely overrated. You don't need diesel, especially these days where diesel costs are so much higher than gasoline. The premium for having a diesel now is higher than I think it's ever been, and it's just not worth it. I'm not even going to talk about DEF and all that stuff. Diesel is not necessary for 99.9% of van lifers. The only time that I would consider it is if I was going to constantly do a lot of towing, especially in mountainous areas. That's where diesel really shines, and that's where it becomes a safety issue. But other than that, nah, way overrated. Last but not least, and this is mostly for the new folks, hookups. Any RV you buy typically will have hookups for cable TV. All right, we already talked about that. Water, city water hookup, power, and often a sewer hookup. I don't think you need those things. And in fact, I think you're going to be better off learning to live without them. Van life and RVing can be separated by one simple thing, which is that most van lifers boondock. And most RVers are hooked up all the time. It's a completely different concept in how your systems work. My Airstream expects to be hooked up. Yes, it's got solar panels, and yes, it has an inverter, and sure, you can run it on the battery for about half an hour. I mean, the thing is just not designed to go a whole night with the heat on without being hooked up. It's not. I could convert it, sure. I just don't happen to need to. But all my vans, they don't care where they are. And in fact, when I park my van in Aurora, Nebraska, which I talk about all the time, one of the few places I go that has hookups, I usually don't hook it up. Because for what? I have everything I need. None of the hookups matter. I fill up my water tank, and sometimes I'll use the power to recharge something if I want to. But I don't have hookups at all in any of the rigs I've built. I will carry an extension cord sometimes, but rather than actually putting in a port with the cord that plugs in or anything, I just will run it through a door. You can shut the door on the cord. It doesn't hurt it. It's one less hole in the vehicle. It's very, very simple, and it works fine. So if you're looking at van life and you're looking at getting a rig, don't worry about hookups. I don't think you need them. And if you're the kind of person who really likes being in campgrounds all the time, well, fine. Then you do want hookups. You might as well have them. But then you are further towards the RV end of the spectrum and further away from the van life end of the spectrum, which is fine. There's no judgment here. It's just that most people listening to a van life podcast are more on the boondocking side of things. Did I get any of that wrong? Do you disagree strongly? I hope so, because I'm not laying down the law here. I'm just expressing my opinion, and I do that so that we can foster communication and conversation about these things. So if you want to correct me, you know where to find me, and we can talk about it. Tech Talk. One of the most common early car owner problems is the dreaded wet passenger floor. That is, the carpet on the passenger floor of the vehicle will get wet. Why is that? What's going on? Well, I think it's a little less common now, but it's still a big issue. And what's going on is that the air conditioner condensate line is clogged up. And it's so, so common. Your air conditioner removes moisture from the air, and that moisture has to go somewhere. And it's collected in a pan or something, and then it drips down a hose outside the vehicle somewhere. And that's why on hot, humid days, there's often a puddle of water underneath your van or whatever you're driving. If you have an air conditioner on the roof, same thing. Some of them will just run down the side of your van. Others are fancy, like in the Airstream, they've got this hose that goes down through the body and comes out by the wheels, which is a pain in the butt because guess what? Mine's clogged up. And it's this gigantic, enormous hose, and I got to find a way to declog it. And so how do you do that? Well, the traditional way is to blow it out with an air gun. You go to the mechanic and you say, hey, my condensate line is clogged. And they disconnect it from underneath your dashboard and then blow it out with a hose. And that makes it good for a year or two or whatever. That's what you normally would do. It's harder to do with the roof air conditioners because that line isn't that visible. Often you have to take the cover off, which is what I have to do in the Airstream. It's a pain in the butt. But a more common thing to do now, and this is something that you can carry with you in your vehicle so that you don't need the big compressor to blow the air hard enough to clear the line, is a piece of weed whacker string. Get yourself a spool of weed whacker string. You know what I'm talking about. They're called strimmers in some parts of the world. And that very, very thick, basically fishing line, it's very thick fishing line, is stiff enough that you can run it through the hose from either end. It's better to do it at the end that's attached to the air conditioner, but if you can't get at that for some reason, you can do it from the other end, and run that all the way up the hose as much as you can, twist it around. You can tie a knot in it if you want. You know, just make that go up and down, up and down. You're basically flossing the hose, and you'll probably get some mildew-smelling, gunky stuff to come out. That's all it is. And then once water flows freely out of there, you're done. But it is kind of important. People have damaged their rigs because of this, where the condensate line filled up and then water started leaking inside the rig, which is not a good situation. Water getting somewhere where you don't want it in any rig is bad. So this is a good thing to know. Classic symptom, wet passenger floor. If the passenger floor of your vehicle is wet, this is almost certainly what's causing it. If you have water dripping down the side of your rig that didn't used to be there on hot days, same problem. And the fix is to just carry some weed whacker line. And it's not a bad thing to carry anyway, because you can use it for other things like, well, I don't know, whacking weeds, I guess. Product review. I said a couple weeks ago, I have this whole big long list of products review, and I find myself doing one that I didn't expect because I am using these stupid things all the time. This is one of the dumbest, least exciting product reviews I've ever done, and yet I love these things. Corel. Okay, you know Corel. It's the basic dishware, you know, dishes and plates, very basic. Glass, but also really, really tough. Now, these things do break, and when they do, it is a disaster because they don't just crack, they shatter into all these little sharp pieces because they're basically tempered glass. They're not, but that you can think of them that way. I think Corel is actually a good choice for van life, and that's what we use in the Airstream. It's because not only is it tough, it's pleasant. You know, it's nice to eat off of it. It's easy to clean. And it stacks really well. A stack of four Corel plates takes up as much space as one crockery plate or one stoneware plate. I like it. I actually am recommending Corel for your travels, even though it's breakable. But that's not what I'm talking about. The thing I found goes with the Corel. Corel has bowls, and they stack the same way, and they come in different depths. And now they make these silicone lids for those bowls. I told you it was boring, but it's actually awesome. These rubber silicone lids snap over the top of your Corel bowls, and then you can put them in the fridge, or you can put them outside so that flies won't get in whatever's there, or, and this is the real big thing, you can cook in the microwave with these things on, and they will prevent all splatter. I have a problem in that I like to make Egg McMuffins, basically. And I do this in the microwave. I have this whole big formula of I put in a little dish that has the egg in it that's exactly the right shape, and I make sure that the dish is, you know, lubricated with butter or something, and then I cook it for 50 seconds on power 8, and it comes out exactly the way I like it. If it doesn't explode, half the time, the egg will explode and make this enormous mess. And I have tried everything to overcome this. I've wrapped it in plastic, and the explosion will go right through the plastic. I've done it with paper towels, same problem. I've stacked dishes, and I've had the explosion actually pop the dish off and then spray egg everywhere. But now I've fixed it. The solution is these silicone covers. And even though they're designed to fit on Corel bowls, you can put them on anything, and I found that with this egg problem, I don't know exactly why, but if I put one of those silicone covers over the egg dish, it stops the problem. And because of that, I love these things. I love them. They're stupid. They're not exciting. They're $16 for four, so they cost $4 a piece, which sounds like kind of a lot, but they're totally reusable. They're easy to wash. And a set of four bowls, Corel bowls, and these lids makes everything easier. It makes me happier. I'm a happier person because I've got these silicone lids for my bowls. I guess it doesn't take a whole lot. But anyway, seriously, if you use Corel, take a look at these. I think they're wonderful, and they've really changed the way I deal with storing food and cooking food in the microwave, and they don't take up any space, and they're tough and easy to clean. So link in the show notes. You can search for Corel silicone lid if you don't want to use the show notes. But of course, if you do, use the link in the show notes. I get a little tiny bit of money from Amazon, and it doesn't cost you anything more, etc. Yes, okay. That was a strange product review. But if you haven't realized that this show is almost always strange in such a way that strange is normal, then, well, keep listening. Tales from the Road. So I just came back from a pretty darn cool trip, honestly. We got on a ship in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and then sailed to the Faroe Islands, and then sailed to three different stops in Iceland, and I flew home from there. I won't tell you much about the ship. It was a nice ship, but it doesn't matter. The ports were wonderful. I recommended everyone visit Iceland last time, and I still do, and I have a little caveat. Iceland is not easy, and it's very, very expensive. We kept running into problems in Iceland where instructions didn't match and things were just wrong and people didn't care all that much. For example, we booked a tour on the Golden Circle, which is, it's a big tour in Iceland. If you've done any research in Iceland, you've encountered this. It's a 6 to 8 hour tour that takes you to a big waterfall and a big geyser and the place where the continents are spreading apart, supposedly, that's somewhat controversial, and a bunch of other stuff. But my wife had never seen this, and I thought, well, let's do that. And I booked it, and the confirmation they sent us had the wrong address on it. And it was an old address. They had actually moved the spot that the tour left from and didn't update their confirmation. And they were like, oh, yeah, you should have been in the right place, but we didn't, you know. So they're actually blaming us for being in the wrong location, even though we were right where they printed it. We didn't even interpret anything. I literally showed the address to the cab driver because I couldn't pronounce it. That type of thing happened a lot. We then rented a car, and it was the same thing. The car rental place had moved the address, but it wasn't on the website. And it took us an hour and a half to actually figure out where the car was. So our experience in Iceland was wonderful. The Icelandic people are incredibly friendly. There's lots to see. But this disconnect, and I think it's because they're growing so quickly in tourism, is frustrating. So if you do go, make sure you double check everything with the company if you possibly can. Like, make the booking and then call them and say, is this correct? Because often it isn't. All that said, I wanted to talk specifically about the very, very, very cool things we saw. We went to an island that had an abandoned village on it. It's called Heimei or something like that. I am not even going to apologize for mispronouncing anything in Icelandic because it seems to be designed to do that for us poor English speakers. But, it was great. We took a boat out there. The boat ride was way overcrowded, but that's a separate issue. And it was just this kind of abandoned village that kind of wasn't abandoned. I mean, there were houses there, but people owned them and used them as summer houses. But the island itself was just beautiful. It was this massive field on the side of a mountain or hill, I guess, with all different kinds of wildflowers and beautiful bay with like a harbor seal bobbing up and down. And it was just really nice. And we went to Islafjörður and Grandafjörður, and they both had amazing things to see. And honestly, Iceland is a little bit homogenous, but not that much. I mean, all these different stops had their own feel and their own flavor. And it was really, really nice. I mean, I felt really connected to the place and very comfortable there, and I absolutely could live there. Some highlights, definitely, that I think people should go to is the National Museum. I absolutely loved. They did this really interesting thing where they have a whole section devoted to, like, the history of Iceland, you know, all the way back to the sagas and 1,000 years ago and Leif Erikson and all that stuff. But then on another floor, they had really hyper-focused history. One was a massive exhibit on the history of cats and dogs on the island, which I thought was fascinating. And some of the lore around this, like, in Iceland, they have this thing called the Christmas cat, who will watch out for you, and if you're not good, the Christmas cat will get you, and, you know, kind of fun things like that. And by the way you find this exhibit in the museum is to follow the paw prints on the floor. So as you come in, there's these paw prints on the floor with no explanation whatsoever. Just follow them, and they will explain themselves, and you better be good. Also, they had this exhibit, like, every decade of the last 100 years had its own section. And holy cow, I'm old. Because I'm looking in the section from the 1970s. I'm like, well, this is all stuff I used. Why is this in a museum? And then the 80s. And then, oh, there's the Discman I used to listen to when I was cutting the grass in the 90s. And that was only 30 years ago. Oof. But it was really interesting to see how, you know, just in my lifetime, things that I used every day and didn't really think much about are now museum items. They had another place that was a village, kind of. Not a Viking village. They had a couple of Viking village things, but that's not what I'm talking about. They had a village, like Sturbridge Village, if you're familiar with that, or Williamsburg, Virginia, only nowhere near as big. At Pioneer Village in Salem, Massachusetts. It was actually quite similar to that, if you're familiar with that. But bunch of old houses turned into museums, some still functional, like, you know, you could get baked goods and there was a coffee shop and things like that. It wasn't completely just interpretive. There were no people interpreting, actually. We didn't encounter, like, the blacksmith or anything like that. It was just you toured these houses. But it was really kind of interesting, and it was the same thing where some of the houses, they would have, like, this is the 1960s and here's all the stuff from the 1960s. And I kind of like that recent history perspective, because sometimes when you're learning about history, it just seems so far away and so distant. But I'm almost 60 years old, and, you know, I can see stuff from my childhood that is now 50 years old, which is incredibly familiar to me. I mean, I have all kinds of stories and associations with it, and it's old enough to be in a museum. And there are 15-year-olds going in there like, look at that crazy phone. Why did it have to dial? I mean, why didn't it have buttons, you know? Anyway, that was great. We did go to the cathedral, which I don't like cathedrals. I don't like churches in general. One of my least favorite things to do is go to some poor village in South America and go visit the cathedral where all this town's wealth had poured into this one religious structure and people are living in hovels. I hate that. It's not the case in Iceland. Iceland is not an impoverished community, although it has been in the past. But they did build a massive church. And by the way, the church in Iceland is the Church of Iceland. They have their own church. It's a Protestant church, It's very low-key. And this cathedral had the least religion in it of any cathedral I've seen. I've seen more religious objects in a Unitarian church than I have seen in this cathedral. There was exactly one Jesus in there. The rest of it was just this crazy architecture that was designed to mimic the island. The island has a lot of basalt on it. It has a lot of pumice and other lava-oriented things, but basalt is igneous. A lot of it, columnar jointing type of basalt, which is what the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland is made of. This Devil's Tower is also columnar jointing. It's a very hexagonal kind of columns of basalt. Anyway, the church was designed like that. And imagine the shape of a cathedral, but instead of flying buttresses, it has these spires of columnar basalt climbing up the sides with a massive tower with a clock on it. And I appreciate that because a clock is actually useful. So, again, I'm not a religious person, so I typically don't like these things. But of all the cathedrals I've visited, that one was my favorite, and I didn't mind going in there at all. I know what you're all waiting for, so I'm just going to get right to it. Van life is awesome in Iceland. I saw so many cool vans and a whole lot of rental vans. I went by Happy Camper and I saw they have a whole bunch of different vans. You can get everything from just a bed on wheels to a full RV. If you want to see Iceland and you actually want to save money, it's not going to be cheap, but it will save you money. Absolutely look into renting a camper of some sort. And one of the most intriguing campers I saw there, I posted links about this in Facebook and Discord, were these fiberglass truck campers on Toyota Hilux pickups, which is kind of like a Tacoma kind of a pickup. These things were awesome because you could just drive the vehicle just like it was a little truck. You didn't have to think about it. Automatics, by the way, most of the rentals over there are manual shift, but these were automatics. And this fiberglass truck camper on the back was dead simple. It was almost like a scamp in design, except it was designed for super simplicity. It had a butane tank, which is what they use instead of propane. This is a big tank. It looks like a propane tank, but it's actually butane, which technically in the U.S., our propane tanks have a high percentage of butane in them, although they're technically liquefied petroleum gas, and now I should stop talking about that, so I will. And they're very comfortable inside, and to lift the roof, they do this in a way I've never seen before. It's pneumatic. That's not to say it's inflatable. There are these poles that you turn on an air compressor, and the air automatically pumps up these poles, and you don't have to do anything. All you have to do is unlatch it, and it pumps up the roof, and then you've got a queen-size bed that overhangs the cab. And then you've got a table and stuff. And anyway, they looked really cool. I wish they had them here in the U.S. And that was kind of the overwhelming sense I had being in Iceland around all these vehicles is we are so impoverished in the U.S. for vehicles. We can't get any. There's like 20 different brands of cars and trucks. And, you know, we don't have anywhere near that much. All these cool little cars and cool little trailers and campers that we can't even get close. And it makes me sad. However, I did really like Iceland. We had a great time there, and I would be happy to go back anytime. And here's a tip I learned. If you are somebody who wants to chase the Aurora Borealis, and you're not exactly sure how to do it, you have limited time, but you really want to see it, and you're willing to spend some money to see it, Iceland. And this is how. Iceland Air, the airline of Iceland, flies to several major cities in the U.S. nonstop. So like New York and Chicago and a few other places. It's 5, 6, 7 hour flight, depending on where you are. It's about 6.5 hours from Chicago. You get on the plane, you fly to Reykjavik, and you find a place to stay in Reykjavik. And you have to do this like in December or January or February. And you're thinking, oh my God, it's going to be so cold. It actually isn't that cold there. They have a very narrow temperature range. We were there in July, and it was in the 50s, like the mid-50s. And in the winter, it's maybe the mid-30s normally or mid-20s. It's just not that cold. It's probably going to be warmer than if you're from the northern U.S. And then they have these Aurora tours that leave from Reykjavik. And they're like 4-hour tours, and you get in a vehicle and you just go north. And you do this on a clear night, and you have a really great chance of seeing the Aurora Borealis. Iceland is just south of the Arctic Circle. It is really far north. In fact, it is much, much farther north than most Antarctica trips take you in the south. Most people go to Antarctica, go to the peninsula, which is what I did. That peninsula is actually farther away from the South Pole than Iceland is from the North Pole. So that gives you a great chance of seeing the auroras. And the skies can be pretty clear there. You know, it depends on where you are. It does get foggy and stuff. But anyway, that's my pro tip. But loved Iceland. Highly recommend it still. I would love to go back and just spend a week driving around in a camper van because there's a lot to see there. It is a very, very, very dramatic country. A place to visit. I'm holding one place out in Iceland separate from everything else because I wanted to mention it specifically. I did not get to have a full visit at this place. Our tour got screwed up and I literally got to run around and snap pictures as fast as I can and then leave. But it's called the Eldheimar Museum and it is sort of a modern day Pompeii. So let me tell you the story. In 1973 on the island of Heimaey, there was a volcanic eruption, which happens fairly often in Iceland. In fact, volcanoes are so common there that that's how people heat their houses. Not directly with the volcano. It's not like, oh, open the volcano room. It's a little cold in here. No, it's not quite like that. But geothermal heat heats water, which heats their homes and their hot water and stuff like that. But volcanoes also don't follow the rules necessarily, and sometimes they just crack open and start covering everything with lava. And that's what happened in Heimaey. The town had this huge volcano open up right next to it, and the lava started flowing down, and they did this massive evacuation, and this was all very sudden, and they were lucky because the fishing fleet was in the harbor. It's normally out fishing when this happened, but because of the bad weather, they had stayed in that day. So they used the fishing fleet to get everybody over to the mainland, which is the island of Iceland, and there was, I think, one person who actually died rather than the entire town. But then they realized they were in serious danger. Not only was this volcano eating their houses, which it absolutely was, it was going to fill the harbor with lava. And that was their livelihood. They could rebuild houses, but they can't rebuild the harbor. And with the help of the U.S. military, they set up these pumps and pumped seawater on the lava as it got closer, basically making a wall, and the lava stopped there and built up behind it. And what you have there now in Heimaey is the town and the harbor and this massive wall right next to it that is the lava that they stopped. Really dramatic, amazing story. But recently, probably 5-10 years ago, when they were digging out some lava for space, And you have to understand how this is. Imagine a neighborhood was like house, 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 wall of lava. And it used to be houses. The lava came down and like ate half of the neighborhood, of this one particular neighborhood I'm about to tell you about. So this guy who's in the last house, there was a neighbor next to him, but that house is now under 20 feet of lava rock. Except that they dug it out. So one of these houses, they actually dug out. And it's intact. It's 1973 in this house. Now, when I say it's intact, I don't mean that completely. The lava did come through and burn the roof down, but it didn't crush the house. The lava cooled in like a cocoon over the house. And while it's not livable or anything like that, I mean, there's lava rocks and burn marks and stuff everywhere. You can tour the house. You can go in the house and like the dining room table is still set and the kitchen is still there and the bedroom's there and there's all kinds of artifacts. And it's really just a really interesting, unusual thing that I don't think you can see anything like this anywhere else in the world. I mean, yeah, okay, Pompeii, Herculaneum, okay, fine. But this is not that. This is much, much more recent and much, much more intact than either of those. So if you do go to Iceland, I want you to look up the Eldheimar Museum, and I'll have a link in the show notes, and find a way to get there. You might have to take a ferry to get to the island, but it's worth it. It's a really cool little island. And this museum is unique. You will see nothing like it. In fact, there was a woman in our group from Chile who had never heard of this museum. And when we pulled in, she was thrilled because her country is also volcanic. And then when we found out we couldn't actually tour it because there was a screw up on the time, she was furious. She was desperate. In fact, as I left her, she was planning on, from Reykjavik, coming back after the cruise ended. She was going to change her plans and come back just to see this museum. So, again, Eldheimar Museum, very, very cool. If you get a chance to go, please do. Resource recommendation. You may hear a cat in the background. That is not the resource recommendation. I am not recommending a cat at this time. However, I am not... It's something you should look into if you're interested in it. There is a YouTube channel called Urban Leaf, and they are gardening in their van. They've got a Sprinter van, and they are growing some herbs and some tomatoes and things like that in their van. And I thought, you know... what they do is interesting. They show you how they do it, and they have recommendations on what kind of pots to use and where you put the plants and things like that. And if you're interested in growing plants in your van, and they're not growing flowers, they're growing food plants you can eat. I mean, they have dwarf tomatoes in there. They're actually getting tomatoes that they're growing in their van. It's an interesting video to watch. It's only 10 minutes long. It's not a huge deal. And I think you should give it a look. And so I've got a link in the show notes. But it's called, if you search in YouTube for Urban Leaf Gardening in a Van, you will find it. And they seem like really nice folks. One of the things they showed that was interesting is that they have an old Sprinter van, an NCV3. And there's a space in front of the passenger seat that they basically converted into like the garden. So it's actually on the dashboard where they're growing this stuff because that gets the most sun. And they water it and they take care of it. But one thing they did say is that every time they stop, they always take the plants out and then just put them on a picnic table or whatever so they can get as much sun as possible. They did run into a few problems. Like one that was unexpected is that the plants grew so much that they were blocking the view. So they had to move them from that spot. And while, you know, you can trim basil and rosemary to get it down and then dry and store the herbs, a little harder to do with tomatoes. One thing they didn't do, but I will tell you is absolutely possible, tomatoes don't have to grow up. There is a legitimate way to grow tomatoes where they grow down. You can actually basically plant the pot and then let the tomato go over the side and then hang. That is a legitimate way to grow tomatoes. They're vines. The only reason we think they need to grow up like they're bushes is because it's easier to harvest that way, and it's also easier to weed around them. They don't do that in nature at all. They just crawl along the ground. So it is totally fine if you wanted to put a tomato up high to just let it drape down. I only know that because I used to grow tomatoes for a living because I've had a very strange life. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 301. If you need to get a hold of me because you're angry at me or anything like that, you want to argue? Let's go for it. You can get a hold of me at jeff@builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. If you wish to make this a public argument, you can do so on Facebook in the Built to Go group, or you can join our Discord server. All those links are at builttogo.com along with all the episodes. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Leonardo da Vinci, who said, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication."